Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of December. I've been looking forward to this interview and actually learned a whole lot about – well, before I tell you what we're talking about, in case you don't know, our guest John Meacham writes in his new book that this president was a source of inspiration to Abraham Lincoln on the eve of the Civil War. He was revered by Theodore and Franklin Roosevelt, hailed by Harry Truman as one of the four greatest presidents, along with Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln. We're going to be talking about Andrew Jackson this hour of the program with John Meacham, who is editor of Newsweek magazine and author of a wonderful new book, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. John is also the author of Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship, and American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. He has been a frequent commentator on many reputable, interesting television shows, news shows, and one of those people, you know how you listen to certain people? John Meacham is one. Chuck Todd is one. He's definitely – John Meacham is one. He's a very thoughtful guy. We're going to be welcoming phone calls as we talk about Andrew Jackson this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, John. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. That was such a kind introduction. I'm going to call every morning.
Well, we'll welcome your call. We can talk about the issues of the day. That'd be great. I'm so glad you took on Andrew Jackson, because I must tell you, I'm obsessed with Abraham Lincoln, and I've read every word about Abraham Lincoln. No, I haven't, but I've read a ton of books on him. And Andrew Jackson is one fascinating president, isn't he?
Oh, my Lord. There was never a dull moment, I must say. I spent about 5 years on this, and it's funny, he dwells in a kind of, and I can't decide which phrase it is, so please vote on this, either obscure ubiquity or ubiquitous obscurity. I can't tell which it is, but he's everywhere, and yet just sort of, it's hard to get hold of him. And my sense was we had, you know, this boom in, blessed boom, I would say, in interest in the early founders. And part of my itch, in a way, was to find someone who represents both the best of us and the worst of us. Jackson is a deeply flawed giant. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that his sins are also our own sins, even now. And so his complexity and the fact that he's heroic but blindly and epically wrong about so many things, to my mind, made him worth reconsidering, because I think that's the rule, not the exception, in human affairs, is to have an era in which we get a lot of things right, but we also get a lot of things wrong.
Mm-hmm. He valued two things, you write, in life above all others, his country and the family, and saw little distinction between the two and had an instinct to fight and to defend both.
He really did. He never knew his father. His father died before he was born, which puts him in an interesting presidential category, actually. Jackson, Clinton, Ford, and Obama never knew their fathers at all. And presidents tend to either have a very strong father figure or nobody around in that role. Obviously, Adams, Kennedy, Bush are the opposite examples. He lost his mother and his brothers in the Revolution. So by the time he was 14 years old, he was an orphan. He was seen as sort of not only the poor relation there in South Carolina among his kith and kin, but a poor relation with a temper. He would mm-hmm. be what we called a troubled teen, I think, or at least would have in decades past. A wonderful story from those days is after he had risen to fame, a neighborhood boy said that they used to wrestle, and I'd throw Andy once, and I'd throw him twice, and I'd throw him three times, but he'd never stay throwed. And he really never stayed throwed. And so his sense was, I think, that the cause of country had to some extent replaced his family, because, and I use this language very deliberately, his family's blood in many ways had consecrated the Union. If to lose both brothers, to lose the mother who was tending to the sick in Charleston when she died, to the cause of the United States, meant that the United States became something set apart and should be defended at all costs and against all comers.
Tell this story, because I don't think it's well known, and you write about it so well, when he was captured by the British, and it is the story of, you know, the leading to the death of his mother and this incredible death of his brother, who was in the prison as well. It's what a story this is. This guy lives through so many dramatic moments in American history.
Oh, Jackson, you can't make this up. It's if Dickens had written Deliverance, is kind of the one way of looking at it. It was this bleak childhood down there. He was 13 years old, maybe 14, and had been captured by the British. Remember, there was this ferocious hand-to-hand, almost civil war going on in the South during the Revolution. We tend to think of the Revolution as Saratoga, the Delaware, Valley Forge, but a lot of the bloodiest combat took place down south, and neighbor turned against neighbor, and it was really ferocious fighting. Jackson was in the middle of all of it as a young boy, and there were massacres where he saw the wages of those. But he had been captured by the British. He was a functional prisoner of war, and a British officer demanded that he polish his boots, and Jackson refused. The officer then hit him over the head with a saber that left a gash the length and width of a man's finger in his head. Fifty-five years later, when Jackson is defending the office of president against the Senate, which was trying to censure him for what they believed was overreaching, he wrote a very eloquent protest. It's one of the most interesting and overlooked documents in presidential history, in which he basically asserts that the president is the direct representative of the American people, that he, as president, is not simply an arm of the government, but the heart of the government as long as he represents the people. He writes that, "In vain do I bear upon my person the memorials of the struggle for our liberties," da-da-da-da-da, alluding to the scar. So for him, it was all I won't say seamless, because nothing in Andrew Jackson's life was seamless,
right, yeah.
But it was an epic story and everything was connected.
His mother, tell me more about his mother and the influence that she had, even though she died when he was very, very young and he was left to defend for himself. Well, they had some relatives, but she still had a very large influence on him, always.
She did. She was, there are really two things, I think, three things. Elizabeth Jackson was her name. She was the first person who actually suggested to Jackson that he might rise to a position of authority among men. She wanted him to be a minister. And in that time and place, the clergy were the most polished, the most educated, leading people in a given community. And that's the first evidence we have that Jackson thought of any ambition for himself outside of farming, which would have been the most natural thing for him to have come to. The other, which is less advertent, is she, because of her widowhood, she had to raise Jackson in a context in which he was a dependent. He was never the actual boy of the house. He was always there on sufferance. And I think that created in him a drive to both defend his honor and his good name against any whisper, any aspersion, which led to his tendency to fight duels rather than settle things more amicably. And the other was a desperate hunger to always be in control of his domestic situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the second thing. The third thing about Mrs. Jackson is the fact that she died tending to other boys in Charleston. You know, she went to help the revolutionary troops there. And Jackson could never satisfactorily find her remains or her grave. And that made him an incredibly diligent keeper of tombs, observer of anniversaries, preserver of mementos. The Washington family took a great shine to Jackson after his victory at New Orleans in 1815 and would send him mementos of the great man. He had Washington's field glasses. He had a couple of Lafayette's dueling pistols. He was someone who, because he had come from nothing, was particularly sensitive to links to a grand and very real past.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and I guess this would have a big impact on you, the number of hours that he would have spent in the Presbyterian Church on Sundays, 3 to 4 hours every Sunday, and also looking at his library, the books you found in his library. Mm-hmm. That would have had a large influence on someone to spend that many hours in the church, right?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm particularly proud of that bit of research because no one had ever figured that out that I know of. I couldn't figure out. I was sort of sitting there, you know, with John Quincy Adams, with Thomas Jefferson, with John Adams, with Abraham Lincoln. You know where the intellectual furniture came from. You know, it's very clear. They were either formally educated or kept quite good, wrote letters about what they were reading. James Madison, you know, we understand where their intellectual armor came from. With Jackson, there's virtually no evidence. It's a real detective story to figure out what went into his head that then was processed and came back out as political action and rhetoric and ideology as he presided over a growing global power for 8 years. And so I was pulling the string back, and very little formal schooling, perhaps a year, but the meeting house, it was the Presbyterian meeting house where he spent the most time in one place. And the Presbyterians, I'm an Episcopalian, so I can say this, the Presbyterians went to church for days. You know, they go to church and they stay in the 18th century. And so you're always 4 or 5 hours every weekend. And so what did he hear? He heard the Westminster Catechism, the question and answer, and you look at his later rhetoric, he does a lot of rhetorical questions and then answers, and the great stories of the Bible. And so you look at what did he fall back on when he was under stress later in life? Biblical imagery. Henry Clay, his great enemy, was not simply a scoundrel. He was the Judas of the West, and his end would be the same. And so my sense is that his religious background was, leaving aside whether he believed any of it or not, which he was not particularly religious until he was about to die, which tends to happen. but it was in terms of simply what went into his mind that then was how he viewed the world. Two other books were important: The Scottish Chiefs, you know, which we now know more or less as Braveheart, which was a story, obviously, of a colonial rebel leading a fight against English tyranny. And the other was Lord Chesterfield's Letters, which was this manners guide in the sense of offering young men who might not have direct access to a father or to an aristocratic background, telling them how to act in the world.
How do you reconcile? You mentioned dueling, and I was talking about this earlier today. What a strange thing dueling is. How do you reconcile what he learned in the church all those Sundays and defending his honor by dueling?
Well, he was more King David than Jesus, to put it rather simply. He believed in the Pauline injunction that you're to fight the good fight, and I don't think he was a figure of of Christian forbearance in any real sense. I think that he understood life as a great struggle, as a contention of the contest between light and dark and good and evil. Sometimes he was on the side of the good, and sometimes he was on the evil side, which is very important to remember. But I think he absorbed more of what I would think of as the Hebrew Bible, those great stories, than he did any sort of injunction. He wrote a lot about, you know, as our Savior said, da-da-da, but physical courage meant so much to him. And there's a wonderful little scene at the very end of his life, in a letter, an account of his last days, where he's talking about Jesus. And he says he admires his Savior so much This is Jackson talking, because they heard not a murmur from him when he was being crucified. So he admired the physical courage of Jesus of Nazareth, which I've never heard, frankly. And I thought that was interesting, that an old soldier would salute someone else who seemed to have endured great great trial.
Yeah. Give us more of a sense and find incidents in his life that talk, because this thread that runs through his life is this, as you call it, a raw ability to lead, a sense of adventure, an infectious fearlessness that was evident very early in his life. And it really governed a lot of what he did, didn't it?
Well, exactly. He was living in a – it's hard for us now to realize this. He was living in a very dangerous world, in a world in which there were the British, the Spanish, Indian tribes. There was a – violence was a fact of life. And he was born in South Carolina, practiced law briefly in North Carolina, and then came over to Nashville. And that passage from the Carolinas to Nashville was quite dangerous. And so he was the kind of man, because of his physical courage, that other settlers wanted to have. They wanted to have him with him. And so he was perfectly willing to take great risks in order to protect others. I think, not to be too reductionist about it, I think because he wanted to be the man who was deferred to. He wanted to be the protector. He had known so little of that growing up that was a role he wanted to fill. There's a wonderful story about trying to elude a tribe of Indians, a party of Indians, and Jackson slashes together a raft, is trying to go across a river. He's about to just completely crash and end up in a very bad place, and John Coffey, his great friend, actually saves him, and Jackson pops out of the river and says, "Follow me, and I'll save you all yet." But he had been, he had been the one.
He was
saved.
The one saved, yeah.
But he was sort of fun, and I think that's a big part of it. I think he was sort of fun in that way. The other story that got him the name Old Hickory was during the War of 1812, when he was leading his troops back from farther down south and west to Tennessee. A terrible disease, terrible hunger, and the doctor to the brigade said to Jackson, what shall we do with the sick? The wagons are full. And Jackson said, "What shall we do, sir? We shall leave, no man shall be left behind, and we should, no man shall ever be left behind." He gives up his own horse to the sick, and he walks hundreds and hundreds of miles. And he was a gaunt figure. He was about 6'1", 140.
I couldn't believe that. I've been repeating that to everybody the last few days. Do you know how much he weighed? A little trivia question. Very. For 6'1"?
And you look at his, it's funny, you look at his uniforms at the Hermitage now, and they're, they're like, you think there's something wrong with them. But that was very much what he was. And he just didn't give up. And in a world of physical danger, men of courage tended to rise to levels of admiration and respect, and that's what he did.
We're going to take phone calls for John. John Meacham is our guest, and he's written a wonderful new book about Andrew Jackson. It's titled American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. John, of course, the editor of Newsweek magazine, also author of Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship. At least that's the book before this book. So join us. Did I give you the number? I do it so often I forget. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls now for John at 800-486-8655. Paul from Cumberland, our first caller. Hi, Paul.
Hi. You mentioned that both Obama, Clinton, and Jackson didn't know their fathers, and Obama and Clinton have powerful wives. I'm wondering about Jackson's wife.
Oh, yes. Big part of this story.
Oh, terrific question. Rachel Donaldson Robards Jackson was her name. She was the child of one of the great first founding families of Tennessee. There was a slight hiccup. Jackson fell in love with her, and she with him, in the 1790s in Nashville. slight bump was that she was married to another man at the time. So things are not all... The course of true love never does run smooth. They had begun divorce proceedings. They believed, they said, Rachel and Andrew did, that the divorce had been granted. They married down in Natchez, Mississippi. It turned out later that, well, the divorce had not been granted. They had to be remarried. It's all very murky, and it was not all that uncommon, not unheard of for a situation like that to develop on the frontier. What's most significant about it is, one, they were so deeply in love that they were willing to risk this to be together. And secondly, what was okay in 1799, or at least endorsed by her family and allowed, was not okay 30 years later when Jackson was running for president. Mrs. Jackson was attacked as a bigamist and a whore. He believed that the cumulative stress of those attacks killed her. Hmm. She died at about this point in the transition between the election and the inauguration in the winter of 1828-29. It devastated Jackson. Like a lot of husbands, he loved his wife rather more than he listened to her. She was a much more of a homebody. She was a deeply religious woman. Their letters are incredibly tender, but the constant theme is her wanting him to come home from the wars, from military expeditions, from political trips, from serving in the Senate in Washington, and to settle with her at the Hermitage in Nashville. He would write back about how much he missed her and how much he longed to be at the Hermitage, but he never really got out of the great game, the grand arena, and that's a fairly common thing among great men. Mm. She was the one person that we can find. There was one other Tennessean, with the Tennessee kitchen cabinet in a way, but it was mostly Rachel who could calm him down. And Jackson, in the midst of a temper tantrum, was a formidable force, and like a summer storm. But she did have the capacity to tend to ground him a bit more. And by all accounts, she was a marvelous hostess. She was, and I don't mean that in a, you know, she knew which fork to use. I mean, she was in the culture of that time to run a big house in the country. You know, people would just show up for weeks at a time, and she was universally seen as a woman of grace and hospitality, which in an interesting way is a way of being seen as a woman of virtue. He was, as I say, devastated when she died, went to Washington. He was so, I would say, disoriented by her death that he made some decisions, particularly in the social political realm early on, that were unwise, and that I suspect he would not have made had she been alive.
And what were those, John?
Well, I know this is going to sound crazy, but the first 2.5-3 years of Andrew Jackson's administration were fundamentally shaped by a social scandal over whether or not the women of Washington, including the wives of his cabinet members, would receive and socially acknowledge the wife of his Secretary of War.
Right. It's such a story, isn't it?
This sounds crazy.
Yeah, it is.
But I just submit to you, for those who are skeptical that a social sexual scandal can lead to massive political effects, I submit the Iliad as an example. So this does happen. Margaret Eaton as Helen of Troy is a bit of a reach, but the basic principle is there. Margaret Eaton was the daughter of a Washington innkeeper. She was probably not all she could have been in terms of sexual morality, but it's hard to judge in real time, much less at this distance. Her first husband, who was a Navy purser, slit his own throat at sea, it was said over despair at her infidelities. John Henry Eaton, who was Jackson's great friend from Tennessee and his Secretary of War, longtime senator from Tennessee, wanted to marry her in the wake of the death. Jackson advised him to do it. They probably had an affair, Eaton and Margaret, beforehand, but hard to say, obviously. But what is not hard to say is that immediately it became a litmus test in Washington whether or not you received Mrs. Eaton. Jackson believed if you did not receive her, you were opposing him on everything, on all political matters. And ultimately, it was just chaos. For and ministers were involved. It's a huge soap opera. Jackson's thundering, and it ultimately ends up. And again, if I could make this stuff up, I'd be a novelist. It ends with the Secretary of War of the United States of America chasing the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States of America through the streets of Washington, trying to kill him. So. I suggest I'm doing some justice to the story, but it's a riveting tale, and it absolutely led to the first full cabinet purge in American history, and shaped the presidential succession. That's what its most important effect. Martin Van Buren, who was the Secretary of State at the time, brilliantly manipulated the situation to move John C. Calhoun, who was then the vice president, out of favor. Van Buren establishes himself as the heir to Jackson, which, of course, he ended up being. And Calhoun, who was already on the road to radicalism in South Carolina, was pushed even farther down that road more rapidly by this sexual scandal.
Isn't this a story, Paul?
Yes, so there was no first lady while Jackson was in the White House.
No, there wasn't. His hostess was a niece of his, Emily Donaldson, who had married Andrew Donaldson, her first cousin and Jackson's private secretary. The Donaldson family makes the Roosevelts look simple in terms of all these marriages. But Emily was hugely important to Jackson. She was she was 21 years old, and running the White House. Had three children in the White House years, hugely important to Uncle Jackson, as they called him. And so he was without a spouse, but had a lot of people around him. And he was very needy that way. He was, having been alone early on, he hated not being in company. And in fact, there's a very moving letter from the middle of the administration. It's basically Jackson, not quite whining, but sort of saying, I have been left to sup alone. Now, certainly complaining that he had, by circumstance, been left alone one evening.
Thank you so much for the question, Paul.
Thank you.
And wasn't it Margaret Eaton who wound up, how old was she, I was wondering, marrying her grandchildren's dance instructor?
Yes,
who was 19?
She was about 59. He was about 19.
Oh my gosh!
And she ran off with her grandchildren's Italian dancing master. She'd moved up to New York to Gramercy Park, and that was even Mrs. Eaton in a memoir that was published posthumously admitted that was perhaps not the wisest thing she'd ever done.
Yeah, probably not. What a hard thing, though, for this man to be going to be inaugurated, and he loses his wife right at that point in time. That's got to be a huge stress on him and great sadness.
It was, and he was very sick. We forget sometimes the human dimensions of these things, mm-hmm. but he had two bullets in him, one from a duel over Rachel's honor and one from a really crazy gunfight. Brawl he participated in Nashville against the Benton brothers of Missouri, one of whom, Thomas Hart Benton, became Jackson's greatest supporter in the Senate 30 years later. So he was a more complicated figure, Jackson was, than people give him credit mm-hmm. for. We're talking about the fun stuff, the sex and the gunfights, which is very real. Mm-hmm. And it's a wild story. Mm-hmm. The country was a wild place, particularly Tennessee and the Southwest in those days. But you don't get to be president, and you don't get to be president for 8 years, and you don't get to be a president who in those 8 years saves the Union, who destroys the National Bank, which you believe to be a cancer on the democracy. You don't establish the presidency as the center of national life. You don't essentially rework the legacy of the founders to shift us from a Republican model, lowercase r, to a Democratic one, lowercase d, if you're not a particularly sophisticated politician.
Mm-hmm.
And my contention is that too many people have or as President Bush would say, misunderestimated Andrew Jackson mm-hmm. through the years. And he knew how to use his passions, and the contemporary sense of the word was temper. Thomas Jefferson is said to have remarked that he knew of no man so unfit for such a place as president as Jackson because he couldn't control his passions. I don't think President Jefferson had that right. I think that by the time Jackson reached about the age of, you know, late 50s, early 60s, in the 1820s, when he's really running for national office, he wins the election in 1824, but doesn't win a majority in the needed number in the Electoral College, so it goes to the House of Representatives, where Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams join forces and deny him the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
He then runs flat out, really, for 4 years until 1828, in which he wins again. He was in those years, he, I think, became the master of his passions and not the prisoner of them.
Mm-hmm.
And one great story from the bank war days was does this sound familiar? It was a great credit crisis. the financial elites were not loaning money. And a group of very distressed officials came to Jackson. And Jackson ranted and raved and spit and spewed, and they scurried out. And the moment the door shut, Jackson turned to an aide and said, "Didn't I manage them well?" So he knew how to use his temper. And the showdown with South Carolina, which is almost entirely forgotten, we had an early prelude to secession in America in 1832-33, in which South Carolina could have established a precedent which would have enabled them to essentially nullify or veto abolition if it were to ever have come. And Jackson, by the way, an unrepentant slaveholder, believed that the virtues of the Union outweighed any individual issue. And so he brilliantly, I think, thundered publicly, threatened to hang the first nullifier he could get his hands on, suggested he might lead the troops himself into South Carolina, dispatched warships to Charleston, sent Winfield Scott. All the while he's doing this, he is writing letters late into the night to his man on the ground in South Carolina saying, "Whatever you do, don't make the first move.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure they're in the wrong." And putting together a legislative solution in Washington that ultimately diffused the crisis. He's a much more complicated figure than the characters
mm-hmm.
would suggest.
Yeah, and helped Lincoln, because Lincoln obviously would be reading about Andrew Jackson as he prepared for the office.
Fantastic story, yes. Lincoln was basically a clay man. It's funny, a lot of people, Lincoln is not alone in not particularly admiring Jackson until he was president and he needed him, needed his example. But he said in late 1860 that the right of a state to secede has been decided. And it was decided in Jackson's time. He decided no, and that's the precedent. In that winter, when he was trying to draft his first inaugural, that terrible secession winter, he went to his brother-in-law's store an upper room over the store there in Springfield, and he sent for four documents. Lincoln sent for the Constitution, Webster's second reply to Hayne, Henry Clay's speech on the Compromise of 1850, and Jackson's proclamation to the people of South Carolina, which was this argument for union at all costs. And in that way, in an interesting way, he sent for Jackson.
We're going to continue. We have an interesting email, and we want to talk more about the Indians. John Meacham, in his book, says that he's recalled mainly as the scourge of the Indians or as the hero of the 1815 Battle of New Orleans. Was he the scourge of the Indians? We have an interesting email that will move us into that area of conversation, and we'll take more of your phone calls. Paul, thanks for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our guest is John Meacham. John has a new book, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. John is the editor of Newsweek magazine. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to an email, John. This is from Robert, who says he takes issue somewhat with this particular subject individual, unless, of course, in all fairness, some degree of equal representation is given to Jackson's final solution to what was considered the, quote, Indian problem, unquote. I am Cherokee, old enough to remember the stories of my grandparents regarding the Trail of Tears. Andrew Jackson did good things and he did bad things. His legacy should represent equal time to both.
It absolutely should, and there's no question that Jackson was a figure of almost unmitigated evil in his relation with the Indians. I want to be very clear. I called this book American Lion, not to lionize Andrew Jackson, but to capture this dichotomy within him, which was that he was a great protector, but he was also a great predator. And if you were on his side, if he believed you were in his pride, so to speak, he would defend you at all costs. But if you were his prey, God help you. And both African Americans and the Native American population were his prey in many ways. There are three factors in Indian removal with Jackson, and there's no excusing it. There's some explaining it. And I am very tough on him in the book about this. And again, I think it's his complexity, because I think it's a national sin as well as Jackson's individual one. The twin tragedies of American life have been our treatment of, I think, those two groups, both Native Americans. The first massacre was 1622, and obviously our original sin of slavery as well. First slaves came in 1619. What Jackson was doing with Indian removal was simply playing out an agenda of greed. There's no dressing this up. There's no putting a ribbon on it. White would-be landowners wanted, we'll take the Cherokees as the chief example, wanted that land in northern Georgia and Tennessee and the Carolinas. It was good cotton land. They discovered the gold in Dahlonega, Georgia, at a critical moment when the removal was at a particularly fever pitch debate, and that was the end of it. And Jackson, as a representative of the landowning slaveholding class, was the architect, mastermind, and executor of Indian removal. One of the things we have to do when we judge the past in moral terms is determine whether there were voices raised in real time in opposition to this. Mm-hmm. And there were. It's actually, I think, a small tragedy that a man named Jeremiah Everts, who was, I think, kind of the William Lloyd Garrison of Indian removal, is almost entirely forgotten now. I think it's because Garrison ultimately won his fight and Everts lost his. But there were very strong moral voices raised against what Jackson wanted to do. The Indian removal bill passed in the spring of 1830, and at that point Congress stepped back. It was a complicated question. They knew it was wrong, morally wrong, but they just didn't have it in them to continue trying to do the right thing. Two other little factors that loomed are not quite as large as the factor of greed, is in Jackson's view, national security demanded that the tribes be removed from being pockets, or in John Marshall's phrase, domestic dependent nations within what I think of as white America. And the moral reprehensibility of that seems not to have occurred to Jackson. He struggled very little with the moral ramifications of his policy. The idea that perhaps the Native Americans might have a reason to ally occasionally with the British or the Spanish in conflicts because of the treatment they were receiving at the hands of Americans, again, does not seem to have complicated Jackson's worldview. And the last, which is intellectual honesty compels us to talk about, but I find the least convincing, is paternalism. Mm-hmm. Jackson always spoke in terms of, I am the great white father. Other presidents had done so as well, to be clear. And you are my red children, and I want you to be saved from the rapacious white man by being moved west of the Mississippi. The problem, besides the obvious ones, with that line of thinking is you can't even credit Jackson with using that as a rationalization, because when the true removal came, he did not take care of anyone. The Trail of Tears is a standing perennial rebuke to generations of white Americans who simply are complicit or not active enough in fighting injustices. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And my sense is, finally, is that Arthur Schlesinger used to say that self-righteousness in retrospect is easy, also cheap. What I think the only good that can come out of history in terms of studying its failures is to apply those lessons to our own time. And so I think all the time about, I have a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 9-month-old. What are the kind of unacknowledged realities of our time that will, to that generation, seem like clear wrongs? You know, will my children say to me, now, exactly why was it if you were a sick American in 2008 and you didn't have a right to health care?
Yes, yes.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You can just, you know, why was it exactly that you didn't have a Marshall Plan mm-hmm. for HIV/AIDS? You mm-hmm. know, it's just, and so I think the benefit of history is not only to find inspiration and hear the trumpets and all that, and that's the fun part, but also the grim and unrelenting work of having to confront the failures of the past in order to figure out what are we failing now. Mm-hmm. And so I completely agree with the email.
Yes. Let's go to Matt from Lake Geneva. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I find Jackson very interesting for his great titanic struggle with Nicholas Biddle over the Second Bank of the United States. This is, for people who don't know, this is a central bank just like our Federal Reserve Bank. And like Thomas Jefferson, Jackson believed that the bank was, you know, an engine of political corruption and a nest of plutocrats, you know, that would undermine the well-being of the common people of the United States. And in these current economic times where our central bank seems to be at the center of the troubles that we're experiencing now, maybe there's some benefit to revisit this question.
Well, there is. It's hard to imagine two Americans less alike than Nicholas Biddle, who was an incredibly well-educated aristocratic figure, president of the Second Bank of the United States, and Andrew Jackson, who never went to school, basically. And they did fight. Biddle joined Henry Clay, John Quincy Adams, and others in completely underestimating Jackson. Biddle took the fight to Jackson. And in terms of the development of popular politics, so the kind of politics we live with now in which particular issues are aired, discussed, and made part of the conversation, not just elections. The bailout would be, Detroit would be an example now. The Bank of the United States was like that. And Jackson vetoed the bank, the recharter of the bank, in 1832 with a thunderous veto message. And I know that's a phrase you don't often hear in that order, thunderous veto message. But it was an incredibly important document. It's really the urtext of modern populism. He says it is to be lamented that the rich and the powerful too often bend the acts of government to their benefit, and that those who don't have time or means to do the same, the farmers, mechanics, and laborers, are right to complain of this injustice to their government. And he did. Jackson's vision was one in which he represented the many against the few. Biddle so misunderstood Jackson and misunderstood the politics of the moment that he used bank money to print up that message and distribute it around the country. Jackson then crushed Henry Clay in the ensuing presidential election, removed the deposits, destroyed the bank, and we moved on. It had complicated economic consequences in real time, as things do. I think the lesson for today is to realize that presidents have to play the watchdog role for the rest of us who are, you know, it's our money going to these big bailouts. And while presidents can't micromanage the economy, the Jackson example is that they can do big things to ensure that we at least have a shot at fairness in what is an incredibly complex and difficult global economy. And it was a global economy then, basically.
Hmm. Thanks so much for the call. Bill is next from Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. Wonderful stories and wonderfully clear explanations and answers. I think I'm looking forward to reading the book. When I was in school, the image I had of Jackson was one a teacher mentioned about his inauguration, and where he invited, according to the story, all kinds of frontiersmen and rowdies and political supporters into the White House, and they drank and partied and trashed the place, essentially. And this is kind of a almost comical interlude to these serious things we've been talking about. I mean, extraordinarily deft in some ways politically, being a man of the people, et cetera, but it must have really put a bee up the bonnet, as it were, of the Washington elite at the time. Your comment, please?
That's exactly right. It was March 4th, 1829, which was the inauguration day. Actually, I think it should be seen in two parts. There was a very solemn spectacle. The inauguration itself was up at the Capitol. John Marshall swore Jackson in. Jackson kissed the Bible. He gave his first inaugural address. He bowed to the people. One of the observers said it was the sovereign bowing to his sovereign, the great crowd. Even the people who were there who were terrified of Jackson, who found this first self-made man, this potential military chieftain, this rabble-rousing man, the first of his kind to become president. Remember, the first six presidents were either from the Virginia gentry or the Adams family of Massachusetts. So it had been a fairly limited gene pool up to that point. Jackson was the first of his kind. He gets on a white horse on Capitol Hill and rides back down the hill, down Pennsylvania Avenue, to the White House. By the time he gets there, this great crowd has, as you say, basically taken over. They almost crush Jackson. He has to be hustled back to the hotel where he's staying. And there was this great, great party. And it was a kind of a celebration of the arrival of the Democratic impulse to a city that had been run on Republican principles for a very long time. And you're exactly right. There were observers, Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story, great Federalist, who lamented the reign of King Mob, Margaret Bayard Smith, who was a great chronicler of Washington in those years, was utterly horrified. And the image that it left, both in Washington and around the country, was that a new era had really begun, and where it was going to end up, nobody knew. If you were one of the many, it was somewhat encouraging. If you were one of the few, you worried that perhaps the smashing of the china and the ruination of the carpets suggested more serious consequences down the road. But it is the most enduring image, I think, of an inauguration in history.
And Adams didn't show up for the inauguration, is that right?
That's right. Jackson refused to call on him because Jackson believed he'd stolen the presidency 4 years before. Huh. And so they had no contact whatever. In fact, Adams learned that he was no longer president and, in fact, was now the second one-term president with his father was the only other one. When he heard cannon fire at the Capitol in celebration of Jackson's inaugural, he was riding to his retirement house. And I think that what you see on that day, both the solemn spectacle of the morning and the raucous chaos of the afternoon, that's in one day, in this matter of a couple of hours in a little patch of land in Washington is the whole story of American democracy. It can be great, or it can be messy, and sometimes it's both.
Mm-hmm. John, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for writing the book and for your fine mind.
Thank you.
It was a great hour. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
John Meacham, our guest, and the book is American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. It has just been published by Random House. John, of course, is the editor of Newsweek magazine and author of the New York Times bestsellers Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship, and American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. Thanks to Mimi Notstein and Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them, but John is a wonderful author and interviewer, and I just thought we would let him tell a lot of the story because we didn't want to be sketchy with it. So that was good, wasn't it? It was interesting. Well, thanks for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock to talk about interesting subjects, as we always do. And there are many more hours of great conversation ahead. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 11, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.